Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's time for us to get going. Welcome everybody to the old theater. It doesn't look as old as it used to. I was a student here many years ago and it used to be rather decrepit, but now it's really been quite nicely refurbished in recent years, and it's marvelous to see the school being given such a new lease of life in terms of the buildings, in terms of the refurbishment of the library and a new library, in fact. Anyway, it's wonderful to meet up this evening, and I have a very great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Arthur Lyon Dahl, who is going to be talking this evening about Beyond Economics, Paths Towards Sustainable Development. Now, this event tonight is being organized by the London School of Economics Environmental Initiatives Network, and for the first time jointly with the Schumacher Society. And it gives me great pleasure to chair it and to introduce the session this evening. My name is Herbert Girardi. I'm chairman of the Schumacher Society, and I would like to emphasize right away that this is not named after a Formula One racing driver. In fact, he's now world champion, or indeed his younger brother. We have considered in the past whether we might invite them to be honorary chair persons, but the condition would have been that they would drive a little bit more slowly. And I think they probably wouldn't agree to that, particularly given the kind of sponsors they have. So we are called after E.F. Schumacher, the author of the famous, really quite famous book called Small is Beautiful, Economics is of People as If People Matter, written in 1976. And he was also author of a number of other books concerned with eco-philosophy and also the philosophy of economics. He was a really profound thinker, similar, I think, in scale and scope to our speaker tonight. He was particularly interested and concerned with the issue of scale of human affairs and human organization, whether it was economic, political, urban, and so on. And he wanted to assure that people did not get lost in the vastness of the mega structures created by modern science, technology, administration, and so on. He was profoundly influential in his time, and in fact, he died from overwork. Having published his book, Small is Beautiful, he was constantly asked to give lectures all over the world, including by people like President Carter, who had a bit of a sort of alternative kind of concept floating around in his head, and asked Schumacher to kind of inform him about what sustainable development really means in theoretical and practical terms. Schumacher certainly was one of the originators of that concept. And he was also profoundly concerned about the collision course between humanity and our host planet. He thought that in our victory against nature, we would find ourselves on the losing side. I think that's a very profound statement, at least I think so. And the Schumacher Society was founded in his name after his death in 1997. Now, we hold lecture events across the UK and publish short books called Schumacher Briefings, and later on maybe there will be more opportunity to talk about that. But first and foremost tonight, our concern, of course, is with the lecture by Dr. Lyon Dahl. He's the director of the Coral Reef Unit at the United Nations Environment Programme based in Geneva, Switzerland, where he oversees the launching of the multi-million dollar International Coral Reef Action Network. He holds an AB in Biological Sciences from Stanford University and a PhD in Biology from the University of California, Santa Barbara. His previous positions have included Associate Curator for Marine Botany at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, Regional Ecological Advisor of the South Pacific Commission, New Caledonia, and Organizer of the South Pacific Regional Environment Program. He has worked as an independent consultant to governments, international organizations on coral reefs, biodiversity, islands, environmental education, social and economic development. He's a Deputy Director of Oceans and Coastal Areas at UMET in Nairobi, and he has had an attachment to the Secretariat of the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. He also represented the Baha'i international community at the United Nations Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm in 1972 and participated in the World Summit on Religions and Conservation. So you are remarkably broad in your interests and the focus of your work, and absolutely delighted that you accepted the LSE Environment Initiatives Network's invitation to be here tonight. So over to you, Dr. Arthur Lyon Dow.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try this evening at least to raise a lot of questions, and I hope I can sort of stimulate you to think about some things in new and different ways, particularly in this bastion of economic orthodoxy that is the London School of Economics. Of course, I do not claim to be an economist. My training is as an ecologist. And so my approach has been very much to look at human systems as I would look at a coral reef or a tropical rainforest and say, how does the whole system work? What keeps it in balance? What gives it its efficiency, its and so on and so forth. And there are in natural systems, are very complex systems comparable to human systems, which have evolved naturally over millions of years to achieve high levels of productivity, which of course is in many ways the goals of our society. And if we look, for instance, at the coral reef, which is one of the most highly evolved of those natural systems, we can see that the more complex the reefs become, the more you find that, you might say, the brutal competition of Darwinian survival of the fittest is replaced by various symbioses of collaboration and cooperation. So you have, for instance, within the coral animals themselves, plants living inside, and a very close relationship where the plants produce food for the animal and the animal's waste fertilize the plant, all within the same organism. Or you may have, you find the little cleaner fish that set up cleaning stations for the large predator fish. And these big predators that eat any fish that goes in front of them come to the cleaning station and open their mouths wide so the little fish can go inside and pick parasites off of its teeth and out of its gills. And you see the little fish swimming in and out of the mouth of the large predator. You know, each one is a service to the other. One is getting cleaned up and the other is getting its food supply. And all across the reef system, there are these elements of collaboration. You have a very highly efficient system with great efficiency in energy capture, renewable energy capture, recycling of materials within the system. Very little is lost from the system. So that in many ways, we can already see in nature the kinds of features that we sort of imagine would be the qualifications that we need, the characters we need in a more sustainable future society. And the encouragement of that kind of organic example is that it shows, in fact, such things are possible. These are not necessarily totally impossible to read. If it's happened in nature, maybe we can, in our own human system, find some ways of encouraging those characteristics and going in the same direction. And therefore, what I'd like to do this evening is to attempt a kind of a diagnostic and prescription, you know, diagnose a little bit of our present system from an economic perspective and say, well, you know, what is economics doing? What is it not doing? How is it helping or not helping with the system? And then look at what might be some of the solutions to the problems. Where might we go to help society evolve in a more constructive direction in the future? And if we start with a sort of a simple analogy, you know, understanding our human society is a bit like understanding an automobile. If you want to understand an automobile, you need to, you know, do a sort of a mechanical analysis of how the motor is constructed, and you look at the way energy is processed, and so you put petrol into it, and it's burned in the motor, and produced, and so there's the whole process of energy use, and so on and so forth. And in many ways, economics today is a bit like the energy component of the automobile. He was making certain that that part runs effectively. But it's not the only thing critical to the operation of the automobile. And, you know, you may be a good mechanic and you do everything possible to keep the tank full of petrol and keeping the oil topped up and so on. But if the car has an accident because the driver was drunk, all the work you did on the mechanical side was no good whatsoever. And in many ways, this is the problem with economics today. We've put too much reliance on our analysis of only one component of the human system. That component that is looking at what is marketed or traded and what is therefore costed and how that element of the human system is quantified and measured. And we use, you know, GDP or GNP as sort of the measure of success in our economic development as if it were the indicator of everything good in human society. But of course, we know that that measure itself, it goes up just as well if the increased activity is due to increased number of auto accidents and therefore admissions to hospital and expenditure in the healthcare system or factory pollution that requires expensive investments in pollution controls that also is causing health problems and therefore increasing the number of people in hospital. Many things go into a rising GDP that are not necessarily measures of increased welfare in society. And there's almost been, in some ways, a decoupling between what has been seen over the last couple of decades in, you know, rising GDP on the one hand, but not necessarily increasing human welfare on the other. It's more or less been compensation for the damage we've done in our urban areas, you know, in our human systems, trying to deal with accumulating waste problems and increasing traffic problems and all sorts of other things, but not necessarily really resulting in any kind of an increase in quality of life for the people who are involved. There's also another fundamental problem with economic thinking, and that is how essential growth is. You know, if any company stops growing, it's, you know, off with the heads of the managers. And any government that's not producing a rise in GDP, that's something fundamentally wrong with society. But this planet is a closed system, and you cannot keep growing forever in a closed system. Sooner or later, you run into limits. And the challenge really is to sort of say, well, maybe we need certain kinds of growth, but maybe not other kinds of growth. Maybe there are limits to some kinds of growth, some uses of resources, and we need to be much more selective about the way in which we consider growth within the economic context than is generally done today. We have the same kinds of, you might see, illogical foundations to economics. And I have no problem with economics as a science. The problem is often the fundamental assumptions. The problem is the values underlying the economic system and the way in which they're expressed through economics. Because we have, for instance, this modern consumerism. You know, the economy is down, everybody should go out and buy, you know, help the economy. And that's been sort of the great call in America, you know, after the World Trade Towers catastrophe, everybody go out and start shopping again to save the economy. In fact, I heard an expression recently that best captures the American way of life today: when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. And I think that probably captures the American spirit as well as any short phrase might be able to do so. And of course, then we have to have advertising to make us want also things we don't really need, just in order to help the economy and build market share and so on. And you sort of say, well, in a world where resources are limited, where there are more than a billion people who are extremely poor, not enough resources to help them get wealthier, you know, do we really need to be encouraging people to buy things they have no need for simply because the economy makes that necessary? So there are sort of logical questions you might ask about the way in which our economy works today. We also have this fundamental contradiction between the need to always be increasing productivity and therefore reducing the labor component of anything we produce. But at the same time, those employees are the consumers. And if we start reducing the number of consumers at some point, who's going to be buying all the products that are produced? And yet we're not keeping up with creation of new employment in ways that would allow people to be consumers. They're more and more unemployed, or we keep them in school longer, we retire them earlier in some way. But in many ways, that's moving them out of the consumer market. It's reducing their incomes, and that's counterproductive to this business that they should be out buying all of the time. So there are a whole series of logical inconsistencies underneath the economic system that really can allow us to raise questions. There are other dimensions as well, for instance, because with globalization, you have the multinationals, and they are creating more and more wealth all around the world. And yet, in terms of, you might say, wealth redistribution, which is a fundamental economic process in any country, taxation only takes place at the national level. And therefore, an increasing fraction of global economic production is escaping from any taxation because it's being generated in profit centers in the Cayman Islands or in places where there's no taxation. And multinationals are very good at organizing things so that profits are made in places where they're not taxed. And as a result, more and more of economic activity is escaping from that taxation mechanism. And it's no wonder the governments are all going bankrupt and the businesses are doing very well at the international level, because we're losing control, in a sense, of the national management of basic economic and social processes. There's also the fact that in spite of the rapid increase in wealth and in technology, we still have an enormous problem of poverty in the world. And it's not getting any better. In fact, you know, there's been a steady increase in the range between the rich and the poor, in the Gini index or other measures that show that in fact income distribution is getting steadily worse. And you have concentration of wealth in the hands of, you know, small numbers of people at the top, and you still have this great mass of the poor at the bottom. And even though there's been some spread of the middle class, even there it's looking rather shaky in terms of the ways in which it's going for the future. So that kind of increasing extremes of wealth and poverty is socially unsustainable. You cannot keep going on with those kinds of things, and the net result is either, you know, all sorts of immigrants trying to break their ways into the borders of the rich countries to get a share of the wealth, or refugees leaving the places where it's no longer sustainable to keep living, or terrorists who go flying into buildings to make a point that they can't tolerate this kind of extreme differences of one sort or another. And I think when we look at some of the problems, you know, presently occupying the headlines, you say, well, what are the fundamental roots of these problems of social instability in the world? In part, they have to be traced back to the fact that there have been steadily increasing levels of wealth and poverty, combined with the fact that with the modern information system, everybody is aware of the differences. I mean, I can recall hearing of some Nepalese visitors, and somebody, you know, came in from a development agency and had come to such a, you know, to help, you know, save them from poverty. And he explained what they come to do, and they said, this is the first time we knew that we were poor. You know, nobody had told them. And you know, one of the challenges of the information revolution is, in fact, the differences that could well have been tolerable out of ignorance in the past are no longer acceptable simply because it's now possible to see how other people are living and to want to live the same way, and therefore to recognize the injustice of not having those opportunities. And for the young people in developing countries who see no possible future for themselves in corrupt, inefficient societies where there's no job creation and no hope for the future, it's natural that they become desperate and, you know, are willing to do almost anything in any way to try to find a solution to their problems. So I think it's important to sort of stand back and begin to integrate these various components of what's happening in the world and say, well, there really seem to be things fundamentally wrong with our present society, our present civilization. There are other difficulties as well. There are some fundamental ethical failures in the way our system works together. I mean, the classic recent case of the tobacco company that sent a report to the Czech Republic saying how wonderful it was to encourage the smoking in their country, because by killing off people early, they'd have considerable savings in the pension system and in health care for the elderly, and therefore this was a really significant advantage for their country to continue to encourage the use of tobacco in their country. Now, in one sense, that makes perfect business sense. I mean, one could go a little bit further and say we really ought to be killing off the unemployed because they're simply a burden on the economy. And, you know, from particular, only a Darwinian system of values, you know, if they're not cost-effective, if they're not contributing, we should simply get rid of them. And there may be a certain kind of logic to that sort of thinking, but I think anybody who has any kind of ethical principles would say, well, there are certain limits to what we see as acceptable behavior and acceptable kinds of proposals. There was also a famous proposal from one of the vice presidents of the World Bank a number of years ago, a memo that was leaked from internally, in which he said that we really ought to be encouraging the moving of polluting industries to developing countries, because life was worth so much less there. If people were killed by pollution, it would make much less difference to the economy. But I say these are kind of, you might say, the ethical slips that indicate, you know, how fundamentally faulty, you know, the economic logic is when it's taken in its pure form. And while we really need to say, well, is economics enough, or maybe we need something beyond that? I mean, you could raise, I mean, we have the same problems as well, for the fact that there are many fundamental needs in society that nobody is pursuing because they're not going to make any money. I mean, who is working on medicines for the diseases that only affect the poor? For malaria and tuberculosis and so on. No pharmaceutical company wants to invest in developing new medicines in these areas because the poor can't afford to buy them. It's the same problem with, you know, various kinds of technologies. There's an enormous bias in technology because some technologies produce products that will make money. But if you're trying to encourage people to treat their waste with local biosystems they can set up themselves and don't require any major investment, you're going to have no company out there developing the technology because they have no interest in it. It's not going to make any money. And therefore, you've got a considerable bias in technological development between those approaches that fit with profit-making and those that don't seem to fit with profit-making. And therefore, they're simply neglected by all except a few NGOs that struggle along. The same is true with the use of biological controls in agriculture. If it's simply training a farmer to recognize some pest and to pinch them off the plants or to plant some other plant next to it that will provide a natural pest control, that has no interest to the multinational agricultural corporations because they can't sell pesticides. And therefore, they're not going to encourage those alternative technologies. Or the same with organic farming. If you're going to replace expensive fertilizer with something the farmer can do for themselves, again, there's no commercial interest. So we have, again, there's sort of a bias in the way society operates in terms of the choices of technologies. The same logic as when you come to, for instance, peace. I mean, everybody would say, yes, we would like to have peace in the world. Peace would be an economic disaster. Who is going to employ all the people in the armies, navies, and air forces of the world? What's going to happen to all of the military-industrial complex and the millions that are spent in sales of arms around the world? They are a fundamental part of the economy, And if you suddenly phased out that whole dimension of the economy, it would be a disaster. And therefore, any attempt to achieve peace has to be coupled by a whole series of economic and social measures to find alternatives for all the people whose livelihoods now depend on getting ready for war. And these are just a number of sort of a little catalog of the reasons why we have to take economics with a grain of salt and say, well, it may be a very good science, but we certainly need much more than that if we're going to address the problems of development and society and the where we want to go into the future. This is not even to mention the environmental problems and the fact that economics isn't really able to deal with environmental and ecological limits on this planet. And therefore, it works at the wrong time and space scales with think problems like global warming and so on, or treats simply things as externalities and says something to be dealt with outside of the system. And therefore, when it comes to dealing with chemical use and persistent organic pollutants, the endocrine disruptors, or even trying to find more forms of agriculture, of soil management, the serious water crisis in the world, not to mention the issues of the nuclear industry. I mean, nobody could privatize the nuclear dimension of power production in the United Kingdom. No private enterprise would touch it. It's not worth it. The long-term liabilities, the cost of dismantling nuclear plants, the responsibility of dealing with nuclear waste means that it's totally uneconomic when you add everything up. It only makes sense because it was all subsidized by the nuclear arms industry to begin with, and then only cost it on a very short-term basis. But the cost of dismantling Three Mile Island in America, the partial meltdown a number of years ago, was, I think, cost it between $3 and $4 billion. And I say these things make it totally, it's just not worth it. So all across the areas, the problems of remediation, dealing with the brownfields, spill cleanups, asbestos, where some of the biggest companies that dealt with asbestos said it was easier to go bankrupt than to take on the liability for all of the workers who were contaminated by it. They could sort of see where things were going in the future. So all the way down the line, we can see that economics just hasn't been able to deal with a whole series of fundamental problems of society. It's had the wrong frameworks, the wrong perspectives for decision making. Another area that's an increasing worry is intellectual property, because we are experiencing a new privatization of the commons. Just as in the 18th century, the commons were taken over by the big landowners and people pushed off the land, so the big corporations are sort of trying to grab all the intellectual property they can, patenting all genetic codes they can get, and trying to privatize scientific databases and medicines and traditional knowledge, anything and everything that might make a profit. And as a result, bringing this information out of the public domain, out of its free exchange, which is what allowed a lot of agricultural research around the world, for instance, in terms of genetic resources, and turning it all to see how it can be used by restricting it in terms of making more of a profit. But it's very short term. It's reducing research. It's reducing innovation. In many ways, it's going to produce counterproductive in the longer term. So it's a serious intellectual crisis in the years ahead of the trends of what is happening with intellectual property. Well, where is all of this leading? Some friends of mine at the Stockholm Environment Institute and Alan Hammett at the World Resources Institute in Washington prepared some sort of alternative scenarios for the future. And they sort of said, well, there's sort of the business as usual scenario. Where does this take us? And it looks reasonably good for the next 50 years. Yes, the middle class is getting richer. Economy seems going reasonably well. But at the same time, there's a steady running down of resources and the steady accumulation of certain kinds of pollution problems and so on. And within half a century, we begin to hit some very fundamental environmental limits, and the society starts to fall apart. The economy simply can't continue in the same direction. Then they said, well, what about all of these social problems in the world? And even a few years ago, they said, well, we might be heading towards kind of a fortress world where the rich countries are barricading themselves in to keep out all the hungry and the dispossessed in the developing countries. So say, well, we give up on Africa. It's not worth trying to save it. It's going to cost too much. We just let them stew in their own juices, put barriers around Europe and North America and Japan, and just try to go on maintaining our economies within our own borders and forget about the rest of the world. But again, it both raises serious moral questions and also isn't very sustainable in the long term. But then when they said, is there an alternative? They said, well, in fact, they could imagine scenarios that were technically feasible, where you could imagine a transition to a more sustainable society. But it would involve fundamental changes in the way things are being done and starting to move in totally new directions and institutionally restructuring society in many ways. But at least the model suggested that was a reasonable alternative. This is not something that we should totally discard does seem to be a practical possibility as an alternative view of the way things are going ahead. And so really that raises the fundamental question, you know, is economics for humans, or are we here to be sacrificed for the economy? I mean, I remember seeing one economic study that suggested that we could have superb statistics on the GNP and also by the middle of the next century in an economy without people. Would you have computers with robots manufacturing more computers, the robots? The statistics look very, very good. And you get rid of all of those, you know, inefficient workers and people going on sick leave and striking and so on and so forth, all those things that interfere with industrial production. And in fact, you could really get a strictly perfect kind of economy and just get rid of these fallible human beings. And it looked very good on paper. But you really have to sort of ask, is that the ultimate direction of our economic system? Is that where we want to go? It may be the direction we seem to be going in terms of increasing productivity and so on and so forth. But again, it does sort of say, well, what is the purpose of all of this? You know, and ultimately beyond that kind of a question, then we really say, you know, where do we start from if we want to go in some new direction? And I think this is where taking a brief systems perspective can help, because we're learning some exciting things about the way systems work, and particularly in terms of computer systems, where they found that when you reach the point in the complexity of your programs, they can no longer keep track of the mass of details and how it all works together. The only solution is to go to a much more distributed system, a neural network or something, where you program a lot of little computers with simple laws and ask them to work out the solution for themselves. And in fact, the idea, you might say, the centrally planned economy was like the centrally planned computer program. It reaches a certain point and it becomes inefficient and it, you know, seizes up and doesn't function. Biological systems don't work that way. Nobody has programmed a coral reef to work the way it functions with great efficiency. It's been a long process of evolution of many species with genetic programs and different systems of interaction evolving great complexity and great efficiency over time. And from that perspective, therefore, you might say that really what we should be doing in sort of rethinking our human systems and our economic systems is say, well, maybe what we need to be examining is the basic rules, the underlying fundamental principles or values. And if we can get some of those right, then perhaps the whole system will evolve in a new and more effective direction. And so I think that's perhaps the last part of my talk this evening was sort of raising some of those questions, saying, what might that look like if we go in that direction? If we want to give economics a new moral, ethical, or spiritual foundation, what might that imply? What might motivate better behavior on the part of individuals? What might help us to get our institutions to go in some direction? How do we make this process a more organic process of change, not one where we're trying to anticipate already where we want to be? Of course, that's the big problem with sustainability as a word or as a concept. You can't suddenly arrive and say, I am now sustainable, I've arrived. It's not a place, it's a process. Sustainability is in many ways just reducing all those unsustainable things, and, you know, like flying an airplane, as long as you have enough fuel, the pilot knows where he's going, nothing is broken down, it's reasonably sustainable. If any of the foregone, you know, has a problem with it, suddenly you're going to crash, and then you're clearly not sustainable. But sustainability, therefore, is a dynamic, ongoing process. It's not a fixed point of arrival. It will be, the parameters will be constantly changing. And therefore, again, in terms of achieving sustainability, some new direction for the future, it's really now, how do we get the rules right to evolve in more sustainable directions as we go ahead? And therefore, it's really also changing into much more process thinking and saying, well, how do we respect the limits and boundaries around us as we're going ahead, that any one deviation from a pool may become very unsustainable. If we consume all of the, you know, the fossil fuels, it may be good for the economy, but it'll put so much CO2 into the atmosphere that the climate change will take place at a very rapid rate and create enormous other costs in adjusting infrastructure and society. So we have sort of, well, maybe we could technologically consume all of those fuels, but can we afford to ecologically? Those are the limits we have to start respecting if we want to go on into the future. Well, what, again, then might some of these process-oriented values look like? If we start with the individual human being, we might say, well, we really need to find ways of improving ways people relate to each other. Instead of finding that the highest goal of life is to fly an airplane into a building, you might say, well, maybe you should be learning to love instead of hate. Maybe we should be encouraging more love and compassion in things like that, those traditional things that religion used to talk about hundreds of years ago and have sort of gone out of fashion. But maybe again we should say, well, perhaps there was something to that after all. If human beings in fact had more love and became more altruistic, maybe society would operate more effectively. If we emphasize principles of justice, justice is really the most fundamental principle for interactions in society. That's sort of the principle around redistribution of wealth. The idea of extremes of wealth and poverty somehow seems unjust. So applying a principle of justice means, well, you might voluntarily want to share some of your wealth because that will help resolve the problems of other people that you see around you. In the same way, if you want to expect people to sacrifice for some kind of basic change in society, it's much easier to sacrifice if you know that the sacrifice is going to be justly shared, that the results will in fact be shared equally, and it won't be some people benefiting at the expense of other people. So these fundamental values are very important. If you want to build solidarity in the world, then you need that idea of sharing as the basis of the values people are living by. If you want to encourage the idea of living of service, not just doing things for yourself, but saying that really your purpose in life is to be of service to other human beings, to be of service to the whole of society, that change in attitude in itself would transform the whole work ethic. You're not just working to make money. You're working because you're making a contribution. It has its spiritual significance as well as economic significance. So putting a framework of values around what you're doing is a fundamental way of changing society. It also may help, given the limits of the environment on this planet, to encourage moderation, maybe even being detached from material things, being content with a little bit less, saying, I've got quite enough, thank you. I don't need to have a second television or a third automobile. I can't watch more than one television anyway. Why should I get one more? And so on. So the concept of moderation in society, very dear to the heart of the Schumacher Society, is another fundamental value that we need to be encouraging at the individual level. Not to mention respect for the environment, for all of this fantastic natural system that we've inherited, that we're now totally responsible for. We've been messing it up in many ways. And only by respecting it, either respect based in our scientific understanding, or perhaps based on our cultural appreciation, or even our spiritual desire to respect the creation of God, or whatever ethical background you come from, that's a fundamental motivation that can transform the way we relate to the environment around us. But these values also have a critical role at the institutional level. Part of our problem today is that we have built our institutions on very narrow foundations. Businesses are only accountable to the shareholders to make a profit. They're not accountable to generate services for society. They're not accountable to do good in any way. They're not accountable to take care of the well-being of their workers or whatever in a strict legal sense. And even if governments may legislate some of that at the national level, in a globalized world, there's no international legislation along those lines. They're not accountable internationally. They've escaped from much of that. And therefore, we also have to say, how do we bring some process-oriented values into the institutional structures and systems as well? The idea of being of service to society may be just as important as one of our corporate values as it ought to be for individuals. That really, we should hold them not only to making a profit, which is a good sign of economic efficiency, nothing wrong with that, but on top of that, we also should be saying, you should be providing some service to society, providing some kind of good. Maybe that would also help eliminate some of the extreme problems that have developed in recent years in certain industries. We should be, again, looking at the principle of justice as it applies within the institutional framework of businesses. And clearly, if the employees have sharing in the profits, they'll be much more motivated to work for the good of the whole company. So if they're consulted, they participate in the decision making. Again, that may increase justice. You might even say, well, maybe the principle of justice has something to do with levels of interest, some moderate level of interest, because some religions were against usury. It's not allowed in Islam and so on, traditional Christianity as well. And it may be that a moderate level of interest makes perfect sense with increases in productivity. But an extreme level of interest is a kind of a hidden measure of exploitation, that somebody is losing somewhere off the long line. Some poor worker in a developing country, or some externalization of costs that will have to be paid for by later generations. So again, we need to be saying, well, values really may have their place even in a strictly economic context. We need to look at the sustainable management of resources and the fact that it's governments and businesses that are in many ways responsible for caring for the resources of this planet. And ought to be saying that, in fact, should be a principle of no net loss in natural capital. If you're developing renewable resources, then you must maintain their productivity. If it's a non-renewable resource, then clearly we should be replacing the non-renewable resource by some other kind of capital with an equal sustainability. and clearly no net transfer of cost to future generations. That's unjust for the future. That's simply postponing, you know, let our children pay for it, our grandchildren pay for it. Ethically, that's not a very reasonable stand to take either. And if you look in a very fundamental way about things that we may never have questioned before, take the market mechanism, you know, the epitome of competition in the market. But wouldn't the market work equally well, if perhaps even better, theoretically and probably practically, if instead of ruthless competition, there was some kind of collaboration and consultation? The buyer and the seller sitting down and saying, this is what it cost me to make this. This is what I feel is a reasonable price. And the buyer saying, well, my need is at this level. This is what I can afford to pay. And they sort of say, what is the just price between us, between what it has cost you and what my need is? Let's work it out together. That might be much more efficient in terms of the perfect information of the market than the present manipulation and trying to hide things, trying to get the best price you can and so on. Ethics may have a reasonably place to play even in something as basic as the market mechanism. So I think we can look at such proposals as what this international voluntary financial equal labeling. Maybe there are ways that we can voluntarily begin to bring some values into the market. There's already a lot of work being done on corporate social responsibility. Increasingly businesses are recognizing, yes, that even voluntarily they have to start paying attention to more than just the bottom line. There are many ethical people in business who've been frustrated that because they're expected to report to the shareholders regularly, they haven't been able to express their values in the business framework. And we need to be able to help them find ways of making business more moral, more ethical, more responsible, both environmentally and socially, as we move towards sustainability. Now, these values also can help us to resolve some of the fundamental systems problems that we have with present society. One of the difficulties is we have a very fragmented approach to decision making. We've so institutionally compartmentalized decision making that it's very hard for us to get an integrated view of the whole world system. Each business is looking at maximizing what it does in its particular area, not without looking at the long-term impacts, or the impacts across other businesses. So it maybe make perfect sense for one business to dump all of its pollutants into a stream, because it's not responsible for the water company downstream that's trying to pump that water out, and having to feed it, supply it to cities, and that has to therefore install expensive water treatment facilities in order to deal with the pollution coming from upstream. Because things are compartmentalized, things are not being integrated together. The same is the problem with dealing with the fact that we have to take a global perspective. And there are very few institutions that are responsible for looking at things at a planetary level, looking at the well-being of the entire human family, and who's responsible for the human family. How do we deal with the Earth as one country, as it has become physically today, even if it is not yet politically? How do we deal with some of these irrationalities that we are still operating at the global level? We have the problems that we need to govern the system globally, but we have no way of paying for it globally. I work in the United Nations. We're always desperately short on the budget because there's no system of global taxation to pay for us. We have to go and beg from national treasuries. And national treasuries are always looking first at national priorities. There's an election to win. We have to buy some more votes. Who has a few pounds left for the United Nations? It's not a very efficient system. So ultimately, if we're going to have any kind of global governance, there's going to be some system of global taxation to pay for it. But no government will think of that today, and that would be anathema to talk about that. In the same way, businesses need a level playing field globally. It's very hard to do business with this international anarchy, with different regulations, different laws, different levels of corruption in different countries and so on. Business would work much more efficiently if we had some rules for a level playing field globally. So I suspect that we'll see business pushing more and more for some effective systems of governments at the global level because they need it to do business effectively. The same problems come up. We have the problems of institution building at the global scale. We have the multinationals are doing very well. We have the World Trade Organization trying to establish some principles for global trade and commerce. But we don't have equally strong mechanisms for the other compensating mechanisms. We have the problem in the environment. The problems are fragmented, a whole series of conventions and UNEP and so on, little bits and pieces, nothing coherent, nothing with teeth. And so there's a lot of institution building still needs to be done to achieve effective management at the global level. We just don't have the things at the present time. As one quick example, take forests. Today, all the forest resources of the world are linked in a global market. You can go anywhere to find trees to make pulp for paper, plywood for construction in Japan. And as a result, the forests all over the world under pressure. It doesn't matter what other values they may have for biodiversity, conservation, water protection. Those other values are not costed in the market. The trees are only worth standing timber that can be cut and sold in the market. And as a result, we're cutting many of the most valuable forests simply because they're the most accessible or the countries are the poorest and ready to sell off all the resources, and the other values aren't costed. And therefore, the only logical thing in terms of management of that resource globally would be to say, so we ought to have a global tax on the trade in forest products that could then pay some countries not to cut their forests because their highest value is for their biodiversity resources or for tourism or some other thing that is perhaps of greater value. And only that way can we sort of compensate for the market pressures that we have today and the fact that those other values are not presently costed and valued. So these are the kinds of changes in thinking that we need to move towards a more sustainable society. We need also to look at questions of social welfare. How do we achieve more effective redistribution of wealth, and not just nationally, but globally? We accept that as an accepted social goal at the national level. We haven't yet built the mechanism to do it globally, and it's no wonder that we have problems of terrorism and other problems that are too evident today that are really expressions of the enormous disparity of wealth and poverty in the world. That's the driving force behind so many of these problems. And only when we sort of face up to that reality and begin to say we need to do something to cope with that and to begin to change in that direction, we'll be able to reduce some of those pressures and perhaps find more effective ways of dealing with those problems than going to war. But then, of course, we've always had this problem that bureaucracy isn't easy to change. And in the past, the only way we've been able to modify bureaucracy has been war and revolution. Nobody has found a more effective way of renewing society. And in the last half of the last century, the two most effective countries economically were Germany and Japan. The two countries that started off in mid-century with well-trained labor forces and totally new governmental systems, industrial systems, labor systems, legal systems, they started over. And what a difference it made for about 40 years until they caught up with the rest of us in terms of their inefficiency and so on and so forth. So maybe there is an acceptable lifespan for a bureaucracy or a legal system, and we sort of say, let's give it 40 years and then let's wipe it out and start over again. But let's do it perhaps a little more humanely than having to go to war over it. I mean, this is the place, again, where values can come to play. Also, we have worked very hard to globalize movement of capital. Capital can go anywhere today. We're now globalizing movement of goods and services. We have a whole World Trade Organization to do it. Nobody will talk about the globalization of people. Logically, people ought to be able to go anywhere and work anywhere. And therefore, we wouldn't have this problem, we're all getting too old, who's going to pay for our retirements in Europe because we don't have an adequate birth rate. There are lots of young Chinese and Africans who would love to come here and fill in that gap. If we have climate change and suddenly we can't grow wheat in the American Middle West, we have to grow it in Siberia, do we have to wait for more Russians to grow up and become Siberian farmers? Can we move some American farmers? If we wanted to achieve, I might say, an ecological balance of the world, which would be a very logical, scientifically, ecologically, maybe we need to do something about the way in which you deal with the movements of people. And in fact, then, if you're afraid of all these poor people beating at your door, maybe you'd be ready to pay for them to stay at home. That'd be a very rapid way of equalizing some of these extreme differences in the world today. People don't like to leave their homes. They'd much rather stay there if they could afford to do so. So it wouldn't be too difficult to push things in that direction. So I think we really need to say that our present situation is seriously out of balance. You might say the global accounts, ecologically, socially, are terribly out of balance today. That things are getting worse rather than better in many ways. That it's probably a situation that's ethically intolerable and unsustainable, and therefore that change is unavoidable. It's either going to be voluntary through an act of consultative will, or we're going to be forced to it through a series of crises of one sort or another, catastrophes, world civil war, who knows what might be on the horizon. And therefore, from that point of view, some kind of a transformation in our values, both individually and institutionally, could provide the best basis for starting to evolve in some new and different direction. And really, that would give us the motivation to make the necessary sacrifices to go there. If we can start changing the basic system processes, then we can allow our society to evolve, in a sort of a sane, organic way towards some kind of a more sustainable future society. You might say this sounds very utopian, but at the same time, it may also be very realistic, given the pressures we're facing. Past civilizations collapsed. Any of you who read, Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire ought to know what has happened in the past, and the USSR is a more recent example of how fragile systems can be if we don't look at their foundations. So, am I a pessimist or an optimist? From my perspective as a scientist, as a global manager, and I guess perhaps as a Baha'i as well, I say that we're really in a very exciting time of transition, that we have the potential to create an ever-advancing world civilization if we found it on some more ethical and spiritual values than those we've been operating on for the last century or so. And we really can achieve in that way a sustainable framework for a new kind of future society. It's going to be difficult, but I'm personally, in spite of all the problems we see around us and all the headlines and papers, really very optimistic about the years ahead. And I hope maybe some of you will want to join us in building a better kind of society for the future. I hope at least I've stimulated you to break out of the traditional framework you've probably been studying here at LSE and asking some questions about the assumptions your professors have been making, and perhaps say, well, maybe we need to, be a little more imaginative about where we go with these economic tools as we go towards the future. Thank you very much. Now some questions and debate.
Well, thank you very much for this very, very powerful lecture that you gave, and it's remarkable to be in the presence of a true radical. You're also a bureaucrat. I don't know how you do the two together. It's remarkable. It really is. But of course, that's why we invited you to give this lecture, and thank you so much.
I'm speaking in my personal capacity, not representing the United Nations.
Well, I'm sure if I just ask for hands, they will go up all over the place. My goodness, yeah. So we have plenty of time, I think, to discuss these issues, and the lady here put up her hand first, and then you are next. And, there will be many, many hands, I'm sure, if I ask you. Now, we can't hear you very well, I think, so it's best either to stand up or else I could repeat your question.
Well, I was wondering whether you thought this new mode of thinking to save the planet might be hastened if women were more involved in decision-making processes. After all, traditionally, they are, social service and unpaid altruism is kind of their thing.
Did everybody get that? If women were more involved in planning and decision-making, would that change the world in a major way? After all, women are always known for altruism and service and so on. How can women... I'm not stating.
I don't think that question was radical enough, because should women be doing unpaid work? I mean, they ought to perhaps paid for it as well. but I think that's all part of the injustice. Not to mention the economic stupidity of neglecting half of the potential of the human race in sort of sidelining it in that way. And I think that there's some fundamental issues about, you might say, if you want to really be radical, we shouldn't be measuring progress in terms of money. We should really be measuring progress and development in terms of our ability to use all the human resources available in society. And if we took that kind of a measure, that the developed society is one that's used the full human potential available to it, young and old, rich and poor, male and female, black, white, and any other, handicapped and otherwise, that would be the true richness of a society, a truly developed society. And if we had that kind of a measure, these other things would fall into place quite naturally.
Are you happy with that, or would you like to...
No, I think that, again, there probably needs a better sharing, in the family, a better respect for the importance of the family in the whole structure of society. This idea of a career, of, getting trained in one area, doing it for 40 years, and then not doing it anymore, and if you step out at some point, you can't get back in again very easily, is highly biased against the female sex. And the much better sharing responsibilities and a balancing of the development of all of human potential, recognizing that education of children in the family is the fundamental part of transmission of values and therefore of sustainability. I would fully agree that we need to rethink all of these dimensions of social structuring if we want to move to a sort of more sustainable future. Much more flexibility, much more recognition of complementary roles, much more sharing responsibilities and say, well, now is the time for the women to go first, I'll stay home with the children, or vice versa. As I did with my wife for a while, yes, I would fully agree.
Thank you. Okay. Lady over there. Now again, would you be able to stand up and shout if you can?
If we talk about systems thinking, what is then the role of the UN, given that there aren't as many sort of global institutions
For those who haven't heard that, what is the role of the UN now in system thinking terms? What can the UN achieve globally at this moment in time?
Well, I think the United Nations has already done a great deal to break down barriers in thinking through the various conferences it's organized. I mean, if you look at the Rio Earth Summit, for instance, where it addressed sustainable development in a very broad sense, integrating the various sectors, the major groups, and so on, able to recognize the roles of all of those in the process. The World Social Summit. We have next year the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg, another opportunity to try to push that kind of thinking. And for instance, in the United Nations Environment Programme ourselves, where our Global Environment Outlook reports are based very much on systems modeling, scenarios for the future, integrating. Systems thinking is one of the fundamental elements of the tools that we use to bring these issues before governments and to get them to begin to break down the barriers that is so often the case within the ministries in a country and learn to think together. We've been working on indicators of sustainable development, for instance, as ways of signaling this integration. But in Belgium, for instance, they had to pass a new law to make it possible for the Walloon government and the Flemish government to share information with the federal government, the ministries to share information, to actually integrate the data into one single set of indicators. That was the force of the structural barriers. So we're pushing it, but it's a long, slow process.
Gentlemen over here, can you stand up again and speak that way, please?
You said that peace doesn't help economies. I think that's what you were saying. I don't know if you were being, what exactly you meant by that, but over the last 10 years in the US, you've seen a huge reduction in the US defense budget. And that was achieved with very little problem. The industry simply merged. The budget deficit came down, long-term interest rates came down, everybody benefited. And all the wealth in Europe over the last 40 years, when Europe's grown at the fastest ever rate, that's often ascribed to peace and the lack of war. And metal bashing industries don't mind defense cuts, but they do always find something else to bash and to sell in another product. So you've got to agree with me. So what did you mean by your response?
Well, what I meant was that if we suddenly had peace tomorrow,
the question is about peace. We've heard that peace is sort of bad for the economy, and this is being challenged by the gentleman over here who says we've had relative peace over the last 40 years or so, and economies have done pretty well. Thank you very much. So, answer to that question.
Okay, my answer is yes. So where the transition is gradual, where you recognize that you need to retool the industries, you need to retrain the workers. You need to wait for the old soldiers to retire, or shift to conscripted army to a volunteer army, and so on. Gradual social change is always possible. Sudden social change. I mean, if we suddenly signed a peace treaty tomorrow and said we don't need any of the armies anymore, then you would face a very serious problem of economic transition. If it spread over decades and so on, yes, we can. The point I was trying to make is that you do need to allow for the social dimensions of change. If you suddenly declared peace tomorrow and said, all of a sudden, just go home, thank you, you're unemployed, you'd probably find that they would come marching in with their guns and say, we want you to make some more wars. Or they might start one just to make certain they still had a job. That was the problem where in Costa Rica, after they got so tired of military coup d'etat, they abolished the army altogether. And have done very well for the last 40 years without an army, thank you very much, in spite of all the civil wars around them. So yes, armies aren't necessary, peace is certainly possible. But you also have to recognize that any major change in society does raise a series of social issues, and you have to allow for that in the transition. So it's the rate of change that is critical, and I'm not saying that we can't have peace because economically it's not viable. Ultimately, we ought to have peace, that it'll be much better economically. We have to recognize that given the inertia of society, it can't be done suddenly, it has to be done gradually. And that's true of many other changes as well.
I think the gentleman...
There's a hand way over in the corner at the end, but look and take one first and then...
Okay. Okay, you come first then, and then you.
You're saying that to make it sustainable, we need to develop organically and not in a centralized manner. And yet, it's going to be difficult to do that sort of in a fragmented system because you're competing with people who have the same value. So I was wondering how you would reconcile that, kind of bring in at the same time all over the world, a shift in value without using a centralized model.
I think the key principle there, again, from a systems perspective, is that we have to look at multi-level governance with great subsidiarity. Clearly, some decisions have to be taken at the global level when we're dealing with global processes and problems. If you're talking about managing the ozone layer in the stratosphere or so on, it's only at the global level that we can deal with that kind of issue. On the other hand, we know that ecologically this world is a very diverse place, and there's no one agricultural system that will work well everywhere. You have to have great decentralization to adapt to soil conditions, climate conditions, and so on. And so the challenge really is to develop levels of governance from the global to the local level, with each doing the minimum necessary at their level to provide for coordination, and leaving as much decision-making as possible to the lower levels in society to keep them as close as possible to people. Decentralize, allow things to go at a human scale wherever possible, but then provide linkages and coordination, information flow, so that even when decisions are taken at the local level, they're taken within that global framework. That, you know, the farmer who's going out to plant, recognizable, what he's doing here can have a global impact. If he uses the pesticide that evaporates in the tropics and is going to condense at the poles and accumulate in the Inuit peoples in their food, then, you know, he needs to be aware of that fact and make his decisions within the awareness of that global context. So it's really saying you shouldn't really centralize at any one level. You should break it down. It's kind of a systems view. You big corporations become dinosaurs, and like Pan American World Airlines or Swiss Air, they disappear, or IBM, they have to break up into profit centers if they want to survive. It's a natural part of organization to recognize you have to grow to a certain level, then you have to sort of break up. You know, just in the human body, it functions at cells, tissues, organs, brains, networks. It's that multiple levels of governance that makes the system work, and that's all part of the organic process.
Do you want to come back? Yeah.
Well, I think we have to recognize that at the moment we have a kind of a vacuum at the global level, because we've very rapidly globalized through technology, through the economy, and so on. We haven't globalized in terms of governance. And there may have to be a level of institution building at the global level. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we need to have a global government per se, because if you think of government at the national level, it's already a terrible bureaucracy. Any more of that globally would be a disaster. But we do need some kinds of governance. And it may mean some kinds of taxation, some kinds of judicial, resolution of problems, some kinds of collective security, so we don't need to have wars the way we're having them these days. And we're going in that direction, but in little fits and starts. And there's still a ways to go before we've found the appropriate organic balance of control at each level. We have sort of feeling our way along, trying not to make too many mistakes as we go.
The gentleman over there, and then you next, please. Well, this gentleman, a loud voice, so I think I can't or don't want to repeat. Hope for the best that you've all heard it.
I would agree with you. Some of my best friends are economists, but and I would agree that I've oversimplified from that point of view, that there has been a flourishing of some alternative economics, to the traditional classical forms in recent years that are very exciting. And in fact, I myself published a book that was partly contributed to that process. For anybody who's interested in reading about it more later. So yes, I would agree that there are some very interesting things going on to explore the alternatives and develop ways of dealing with them, and I think it's very exciting to see that happening. But still, when you get out of, you might say, academia into the hard business world, you find that some of those ideas haven't penetrated very far. And there's still a long ways to go before in, the wider, hard-bitten schools of practical reality, so to speak, at least as they define it or as they see it, begin to accept some of these newer ideas and this newer thinking.
Well, maybe this is a good moment to hold up a book here, and that's written by this gentleman here. It's called The Eco-Principle, Ecology and Economics in Symbiosis. So I think that book may answer some of the points that you've raised. I think it's probably difficult for you to go into all these details. It was published by Z Books in 1996, just before they actually had a website in 1996. So you probably have to get in touch with them direct if you want to buy it. So once again, The Eco-Principle, Ecology and Economics in Symbiosis by Arthur Lyme Dow. So I'm sure that's clearly a book that would answer some of the points that you've raised there.
Yeah, and cite some of the people you're probably referring to in ecological economics as well. But it's hard to cover everything in 45 minutes.
The gentleman there had his hand up first.
I just wanted to ask you, in the context of current world events and the Rio Plus 10 summit coming up next year, are you still optimistic about there being the necessary political will to start moving in the sort of direction you outlined?
I'm afraid that the politicians always seem to be last in these processes, far behind public opinion, far behind even business, and they are also very far behind in planning for the World Summit. They still don't know what the agenda is going to look like, what the primary issues are going to be. South Africa is saying that it ought to be poverty as the key issue. But they're sort of waiting to start their prep comms in January to begin to pull these issues together. There have been regional meetings going on to try to raise some of the issues. But the fact that there's such a vacuum of imagination at the governmental level does leave the door open for civil society, for NGOs, for the academic community and others to throw in some good ideas, and maybe in desperation governments will take them up next year. And so I think from that point of view, I'm still reasonably optimistic. It's not an easy process because, of course, for the Rio Earth Summit, I was in the Secretariat, and one of my jobs was sort of catch all of these ideas and put them in something of crystal clear prose in Agenda 21 that all governments would sign on to and not know necessarily what they'd agreed to in detail, but find that they were actually doing some constructive things afterwards. So there's a certain diplomatic challenge to do this, but I think that I haven't yet given up on the summit, but it's very late, and we just have to see what happens now.
Gentlemen here.
On the relationship between the Baha'i religion and this view of sustainable development that you've expounded upon, especially in light of the events which have recently taken place in our world.
Well, I think that I don't know how many of you know much about the Baha'i faith or the Baha'i community, but I think what they've been trying to do is to set a little demonstration product, a sort of a model of the alternative society might evolve in by starting with a fundamental set of values and saying, let's put it into practice, in local communities around the world. How does it fit in different cultures and different societies? Do these things work everywhere, or do they seem to be more limited in their scope? And so I think they've at least gone far enough now that there is, you might say, a pilot scale model of alternatives that might indeed work. And from that point of view, I find it very encouraging. And, it's certainly helped me in my own work in various places to be able to collaborate with Baha'i communities and to learn something about the multicultural ways in which you can approach these issues and the ways that you can integrate both the very practical scientific and the more, mystic or spiritual sides of life into something that is holistic and makes sense.
Thank you for that. Gentleman there?
Yeah. Would you say that the solution, or one of the solutions to deforestation, is to pay states and landowners as sort of a rent?
This is a question about forests and whether or not we should pay governments and countries rent for not deforesting their land.
Well, in the present situation at which the non-market values aren't being valued and taken into account, and therefore people who may be very poor and they have the forest as one of their resources and they know that resource is worth so much on the market, and you say, no, you have to stay poor, you can't develop because your forest has some other value, in that kind of a context, yes, it may well make sense to say, because of the biodiversity value of your forest, which is a value to the whole world community, much more than to you individually, it's an international or global value, the kind of thing that the Global Environment Facility was set up to support, then it might make sense to say, well, you know, instead of you're cutting it down because you're desperate, you know, we should be paying you some kind of a rent to preserve that global biodiversity value of the forest. So some kind of mechanism that would allow for an application of the principle of justice to the development of forest resources and recognizing all of their uses and all of their values would indeed make sense in a global perspective, yes.
General over there.
Did everybody hear the question, or we need to repeat it? Well, okay. The question was, you know, what about this great diversity of values in the world? How do you agree on some values? And I think, again, the solution is the organic solution. Rather than trying to impose one system of values, you should be encouraging people to consult among themselves and themselves come to their own, you know, value criteria in their own context, in their own society, in their own culture. There may be certain global norms that everybody agrees to. And when you look at, say, all the major religions, they're pretty close in the way in which they look at some of these things. But still, there are expressions of that. I mean, even in things as scientifically clear as, you know, the level of pollutants that you might allow in a country, you may have to choose, you know, levels of health impact that you're willing to accept. And if it's a matter of starving to death or accepting some health, you may say that even though we know scientifically how many people are going to be injured, our value here in our present context is down there, where a highly developed society might only accept that level. You know. And therefore, I think it's much more, again, it's a process question. The critical thing is that all of the people be involved in consulting on their values and building their own consensus on the values that are most applicable in their own context, and searching for the truth that is most appropriate in their situation, which is why you need multiple levels of governance and allowing the system to be taken at the levels most appropriate to any particular problem or issue.
Gentlemen there.
Is there a question not directly related to the talk itself?
Shout as loud as you can.
Is there a question not directly to do with the talk itself? But I was wondering how seriously we should take the reports that coral reefs are going to vanish in about 50 years' time.
Will coral reefs vanish in 50 years' time?
I suppose you'd pick me. I'm a moderate on that. I may seem rather radical in other areas, but being responsible for the global program to deal with coral reefs, it's an issue I've been dealing with on a daily basis and following the literature very closely. And since my training is in coral reef ecology, it's something I've worried about for a long time. Definitely, many coral reefs are threatened and could well disappear as functioning reef-building systems over the next 50 years. Both because of climate change and the fact that they're already living very close to their maximum temperature limits, but also because as carbon dioxide levels increase, that seems to be interfering with the ability of reefs to calcify. It changes the pH in the water and therefore brings the calcium out of solution and makes it unavailable and upsets the calcium. So that corals may survive as individual organisms and some coral communities may survive as communities, but reef building as we have known it may in many places disappear over the next 50 years if the trends continue as they seem to be at the present time. Now, on the other hand, the coral reef ecosystem as a system has been around for millions and millions of years. You can go back 20 million years and you find coral reefs very much like the coral reefs today. So it could well be, if we're able to reverse some of those conditions, that we could, you know, reestablish coral reefs as constructing biological structures at some time in the future. It all depends on, you know, sooner or later under what conditions. It may also be, some of the recent work also suggests that maybe corals bleach and expel their zooxanthellae in order to try to get another variety of zooxanthellae that's better adapted to higher temperature conditions. It may be kind of an extreme survival mechanism. So maybe also reef systems who could accelerate their evolution to adapt to some extent to those changing conditions. I don't yet close the door totally on coral reefs. There's still, we don't know, there are a lot we don't know about the system and how it operates. There's clearly, you might say, there's some basis for those extremist predictions, but I still tend to be moderate. You know, I'm a great believer in resiliency in biological systems. It's amazing what survives if you give it a half a chance. And I still would sort of go on the side of resilience, say we're going to see lots of damage. You may not see the coral reefs that I saw 20 years ago when I began doing research on reefs, 20, 30 years ago. I don't dare go back to many places in the world because already there's been a serious decline in most reefs around the world. But, you know, so I said the near-term vision is pretty grim, but I think in the longer term there's still some hope.
Do you think we're going to have a similar resiliency of the capitalist system as well, though?
Well, I suspect that the capitalist system as we know it today, years may be lumbered, but many of the elements of it may find their ways into whatever new system we build in the future.
Excuse me, there's somebody up just above you.
Sorry.
You'll be next. For those of you, by the way, who are leaving now, if you want to come and join us in Beaver's Retreat on the fourth floor after the lecture, you're very welcome to do so. So stick around or see you up there, some of you anyway. Sorry, this question is about sustainability. Are we seeing the implementation of sustainable development since Rio Earth Summit or not? What is happening?
Well, clearly there's been progress on the legal level. There were the conventions that were signed in Rio. There have been other conventions signed since the certification on organic pollutants. There's been some considerable progress, but it's all relatively soft law in the sense that none of those conventions have any real teeth. It's all based on sort of moral persuasion, you know, embarrassing governments if they don't fulfill their commitments under the conventions. You know, governments aren't yet ready. I mean, one of the problems with the Kyoto Protocol under the Framework Convention on Climate Change was, should it in fact be legally binding or not? And one of the last-minute compromises to save the protocol was, in fact, not to accept legally binding limits. So we're sort of tiptoeing along. We're making some progress, but not at the rate that we need to if we're really going to address some of these problems. I mean, even the Kyoto Protocol, as far as it went, was only dealing with 5% of the problem. It was far from what was going to be enough to really turn climate change around. So yes, there has been progress, which is encouraging, but no, it's not nearly enough.
The gentleman over there, I think, wants to... So for those of you upstairs who haven't heard this, it's all about solutions. Do you have solutions or not?
Well, there were references made to solutions at various timescales as well. With respect to the coral reef dimension of your question, yes, there are solutions on a geological timescale, but that's not very interesting for human beings. When you look at a human timescale, you look at the millions of people who depend on coral reefs for their protein supplies in developing countries or for tourism, the short-term collapse of the coral reefs would be an economic and, you know, social disaster. The problem is different scales. Yes, they may well be able to evolve some new and adapted system in a million years' time or so, but we can't really afford to wait that long. Yes, I would fully agree there are processes that operate at long system scales that will be able to take many things on and adapt. but the gap with what our immediate requirements are in terms of economics and development is quite considerable. And we're human beings, therefore our perspective is a bit shorter term, and we have to say, what can we do at that scale of things to either prevent the damage or to reestablish some kind of a balance? With respect to the solutions, you might say, at the legal institutional level, you know, yes, we tried once with the League of Nations after World War I. It was not very effective at all. After World War II, we tried again with the United Nations, but we built into it some fundamental flaws that prevented it from being effective in some ways. It did a lot of technical good. It hasn't been able to resolve many of the fundamental problems. My question really would be there, given the nature of the transition we still need ahead, what is it going to take to finally push humanity to take a few more steps in the right direction to build some mechanisms that really work effectively? I mean, the flaws in the UN are partly its form of financial support, that it depends on assessed contributions that usually don't come in or that can be withheld for political reasons. It has a few teeth in Security Council, but most of the specialized agencies don't have anybody enforcing what they're trying to do. It's all voluntary. And therefore, yes, it's done a certain amount of good, but it's not yet what we really need. There's some more steps that are still required. Education is absolutely fundamental to sustainability in general, because none of us is going to live forever. And therefore, education is that fundamental part of society which we transmit our experience, our knowledge to the next generation. No society is sustainable if it doesn't have education. It's the fundamental process of maintaining the dynamics of human society from generation to generation across generations. It's also fundamental to any transformation of values. Values are only changed through education. Scientific, religious, cultural, or whatever. And therefore, education is a critical part of the solution.
I have a sense that we are coming close to the end of this, so maybe one more question, or two more questions, maybe. I think that will be the last questions then. The gentleman over there first. So this is about values and conflict. Are they competing with each other?
Well, but this is, I think, precisely why you need to look at this within... Well, there are two different dimensions. One is that there may be some basic framework of universal values, which we've already seen in the Declaration of Human Rights, where there seems to be kind of a general global consensus that, you know, we value human life, and therefore things that take human life are probably unacceptable in terms of human values as they're seen in the world today, and so on. So there may be a certain bottom line. But then it's a process concept. It needs to be a process of consultation. There are always differing opinions. And it's through the clash of differing opinions that you can finally seek out the truth. But if it's done in a framework of other values of love and appreciation for the human being and respect for other people and so on, then you listen to the other person and their different set of values. You say, well, they have that value, I have this value. Is there something in between that harmonizes the two of them in some way that we both find is acceptable?
And gentleman there? So for those upstairs who haven't heard this, this is a question about the community of insecurity, whether America has now joined the global community of insecurity and how it's likely to address this issue.
Certainly, I think they've taken a step in the right direction. I don't yet know if it's going to be lasting enough, but then we don't yet know how events are going to unfold and what else may still happen to shake them up a little bit more in their fundamental assumptions about the rest of the world. Only when all nations begin to work together instead of fighting for their own self-interest will we see the kind of evolution that we need. And already we saw at the Rio summit when the previous President Bush said something to the effect that I'm not the president of the world, I'm the president of America, I'm here to defend American interests. You know, that was the set of values with which he was approaching these fundamental global issues. It didn't work very well. Only when all nations recognize that we're all on this boat, this planet together, and we need to work together. And so one can hope that that process of evolution has now begun in America. I have no way of predicting how quickly it would evolve. I've been extremely concerned, sort of standing back from my global perspective and saying, well, there's so much reliance on the American economy, and yet America is the world's most indebted nation. And the day that the international investors lose confidence in that and move their capital elsewhere, nobody can bail us out. The IMF isn't strong enough. I mean, they had enough trouble with Mexico and Thailand and Korea and so on. Who would bail out the United States? And it's all been based, as you said, on psychology. And psychology is a very vulnerable commodity. So yes, we're at a very critical time, a very vulnerable time, at which the great pillar has suddenly starting to shake. Now the question is, will it shake and collapse? Will it shake and join us and start working for change? I can't predict the future, but it's an interesting time to be in.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of this evening, and I think there's a lot of life tonight that's come into the old theater here. You've given us the most profound experience and insight into your worldview, which I think is shared probably by many of us here. I think we're all leaving this room much richer than we were when we came here this evening. And this sort of theme of the renewal of a world out of balance has really been a most profound experience tonight. So we can now go together to the Beavis retreat on the fourth floor. And I'd just like to point out to you three people who are part of the LSE Environmental Initiatives Network. Michael Gill over here. Great, thank you. And David Kingsley over here. And Michael Kendall over here. So all of us are involved in the LSE Environmental Initiative Network, as well as some of us involved in the Schumacher Society as well. I'd just like to quickly make a couple of announcements about future events. Firstly, the Bristol Schumacher Lectures on the 28th of October, Sunday the 20th of October, in other words, this coming Sunday, on the roots of health at the Victoria Rooms in Bristol. Speakers are David Abrahams, an anthropologist and ecologist, Vivian Howard, an toxicologist from the University of Liverpool, and Romy Fraser from Neil's Yard Remedies. Secondly, we have a conference that I'm involved in, not in my capacity of Schumacher Society, but at Middlesex University, on regeneration and sustainable development in London at the Tottenham campus at Middlesex University on the 7th of November. Finally, the next event in this series of LSE Environmental Initiatives Network and Schumacher Society events is Teddy Goldsmith, the founder of and publisher of the Ecologist magazine, author of many books. It was featured in the Visionaries series on Channel 4 a couple of years ago. He's going to be talking about rethinking economics, following on, I'm sure, in your footsteps. He has obviously other perspectives as well, I'm sure, but a fascinating man, a profound thinker, and one of the pioneers of the green movement in this country. That's on the 30th of January here in the Old Theatre. 30th of January 2002, of course. So we are now going upstairs in a minute, but before we do that, I'd just like to hold up a couple of Schumacher briefings, one on sustainable education, one on the ecology of money, the ecology of health, books, short books on aspects of sustainable development. But once again, I would like to hold up your book, The Eco Principle. I would like to thank you very, very much indeed on all our behalf for giving a very, truly inspiring lecture.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much. And the applause speaks for itself. Thanks, everybody, for coming. See you upstairs.